Hello, hi. Welcome, everyone. My name is Meredith Rosner. I'm from the Mannheim Center of Criminology here at the LSE, and my job is to welcome you, so I've got an easy and fun task for today. It looks like a really fantastic day. I'm so pleased to be here and so pleased that we have such a good turnout. Today's event is exactly the kind of thing that makes criminology at the LSE special. It's bringing together creative and interdisciplinary folks to take a fresh look at media representations of prison and prison life. As many of you know, this is a topic of central concern to many criminologists, including some of today's speakers. Marianne and Ioana will provide some more information about the program in a minute. They've done a fantastic job of bringing you all together today and bridging the gap between the academic community and those who write about crime and justice. The success of today is a reflection of their hard work, so really just thank you so much. Yeah. Just a reminder, this event is being recorded, so if you are a speaker, just try to vaguely talk towards the microphone. For those of you, just a quick introduction, for those of you who don't know our organizers well, Marianne's a visiting research fellow here at the Mannheim Center. After 13 years as a TV script writer, including for The Bill and Brookside, she moved into academia, and she completed her PhD here in criminology at the LSE. Her first book, Media Representations of Police and Crime, Shaping the Television Drama, examines how the production process impacts storytelling in crime dramas. She's currently working on a book about crime reporting in the digital age. Ioana also completed her PhD at the LSE in the Department of Methodology, and she's currently a course tutor in the Department of Sociology. She brings a focus on developing innovative methodological perspectives to understand how people process information about crime, particularly what makes us afraid of crime, topic of relevance for people who write about crime. Today's event is chaired by Janet Foster from the Department of Sociology, so if Janet says you're out of time, then you have to listen to her and wrap it up. So Marianne and Ioana have brought you all together today for a series of discussions around prisons, prison narratives, and the media. I do hope you enjoy yourself. I'm really looking forward to the event. I'm going to stay here for as long as I can. And if you are interested in anything more broadly criminological, come speak to me or visit our Mannheim Center website, where we have a whole bunch of different events and programs if you're interested. I'm going to pass off to Marianne and Ioana, and again, just thank you. And I'll meet you all a bit later today. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marianne, and I'd like to welcome you here today and to thank you all for coming. I'd like to say a big thank you to our panelists, because I know that you've all travelled a long way, in some cases given up a day's work, which is not inconsiderable, and also to you, the audience, because I know a lot of you have also come a long way, and in some cases rearranged teaching commitments and other things to be here. So big thank you to you all from Ioana and myself. I also need to say a few other thank yous. I need to say thank you to the Social Policy Association, who gave me the original grant to do this, to LSE Sociology, who gave Ioana an extra grant to contribute to the overall running of the day. And I'd also like to say, I'm not sure if she's here, a thank you to our fantastic events manager, Maria, without whom... Yes, please. I want to say a big thank you to her, because without her holding our hands and telling us what to do, this day would not have run as smoothly. Just sing your praises and say thank you before you disappear. So, why are we all here today? I'm going to talk in a minute about the structure for the day, because it's not going to be a typical academic conference. But first of all, I want to talk a little bit about why we're all here and what I hope, and Ioana hopes, we're all going to get out of this. I think fundamentally today is about bringing together two groups of people who traditionally really don't have much to do with each other, and yet whose work is of concern to each other. And that's academics, particularly criminologists, and those of you who are working in the criminal justice system, and crime writers, filmmakers, and documentary makers. And we're all here to talk about existing narratives, existing media narratives on prisons and penal issues, to challenge them, to discuss what's not being put in the picture, why that is, and what can be changed. Now, as some of you know, I have a foot in both worlds. As Meredith said, before I became an academic, I used to be a crime writer. And I came here 15 years ago to do my master's with Professor Paul Rock, who's here in the audience, and Janet, who then went on to be my PhD supervisors. And one of the things that was a real eye-opener for me, coming as a scriptwriter to do my master's midlife, was first of all the amount of criminological literature there was on crime shows that I'd worked on. And it was quite gobsmacking, really, because I thought there would be in film and cultural studies, but not necessarily in criminology. And I talked about it to a number of colleagues, and they were quite surprised. And I also talked about it to Tony Garnett. And one of the things that he said really struck me, which was, that's all well and good, but why aren't the academics coming to talk to me? Why aren't they coming to talk to us about why we are writing the stories we are, if these stories are of such concern to them? So that was the first thing. No one's talking to the crime writers. The second thing, and that had particular resonance with me, was, and we'll talk about that in more detail, Joanne and Janet will talk about this, were the concerns that criminologists and others had about media representations, more generally of crime, of policing, and the subject of this conference, of prison issues. And just to summarise very briefly, some of the things that criminologists always say are left out of the picture are issues such as mental health, suicide, overcrowding, violence. And as Rod Earl, who's going to be one of our speakers, said to me in an email, what's also left out is how boring prison life is, how sad it is. So this was, I think the next question is, okay, so much is being left out of the picture, but does it really matter? In fact, this was a question that was asked to me at my PhD viva. You know, shouldn't television drama be there just to entertain? Do we expect it to inform as well? Well, I think it is obviously of huge importance for a number of reasons, three reasons in fact. First reason goes without saying. For most people, the mass media are the main source of their knowledge about the police, about crime, about prisons. I know when I started my career as a television writer on The Bill way back in 1990, and I was taken around a police station, I remember thinking, oh, that's a bit like The Bill. No, that's not like The Bill, that's like The Bill. All my impressions had come from watching television shows. But we also know more seriously that criminal justice systems depend on public confidence for their effective operation. And we also know that poorly informed public opinion can lead policy response towards ineffective or inappropriate responses to crime, to penal issues. But I think something else that's also important, if we're talking about television drama, television documentaries, is that they shape not only people's understanding, but people's sensibilities. For example, I talked to a murder detective when I was doing my PhD research, and she said that a number of witnesses to a recent crime, a recent murder, were just not coming forward, and it was all because of something they'd seen in The Bill, and they feared that they were going to be treated the same way. And I don't know how many murder detectives have told me, other detectives have told me along the way, why do police officers always shout in interviews? We don't do this. It's very quiet, it's very calm, it's very choreographed. So those are the concerns, if you like, from the academic, the criminal justice point of view. But I also think, for those of you, and about half the audience here today are crime writers, are filmmakers, I think as somebody who was a crime writer, who's now gone over to the other side as an academic and as a viewer, the best stories for me are grounded in research. I think, Jeff is nodding in the audience, but I know that when I watch police and prison stories now, I get irritated, not just if I see that the procedure's wrong, but I can tell if they're drawing on tired old cliches or if they're ripping off story ideas from other shows. And I may be biased, but I think one of the reasons why The Bill, for example, is so fondly remembered, and for those of us who worked on The Bill, it was a great show to work on, it was because research came first. Before we started writing, we had to spend time with police officers. We were told we had to base our stories on observation, on talking to police officers. So I think in terms of what this day is all about, it's about bringing together those two very different groups of people to share ideas, to share experiences, to talk about penal issues, and to see if fruitful working collaborations can be set up, both on a research level, but also as a resource for those crime writers and filmmakers in the audience. So just a little bit about how the day is going to work, because I've said it's not going to be the norm in terms of an academic conference. So in the morning, we're going to have two panels. So the first one, we're going to have Professor Richard Sparks, who is an expert in writing about television drama. His first book was about the moral terrain of crime drama, has written widely on crime and punishment. And he's going to be talking with, in conversation with Alex McBride, with Dan Sefton, and with Sean Black, all of whom have either written prison stories or are in the process of writing stories, and they're going to be talking generally about the content of these narratives, of stories about prisons. Then after that, we are going to have a second panel with Professor Yvonne Jukes, who is also an expert who's written very widely about prisons, about crime in the media, about punishment. And she will be in conversation with the working class academic, activist and filmmaker, Deirdre O'Neill, with the former prison governor and Jeff Hughes, who is now prison advisor on a number of shows, including EastEnders. And we've also got a very late addition to the panel, Roger Grafe, the filmmaker, who is also a visiting professor here. And I should add that means that there's going to be a slight change to the programme. Because Roger is a late addition, that panel will now run from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock. The breakout groups, which I'll talk about in a moment, will be from 1 to 1.30, and we'll just have half an hour for lunch. Now, in terms of breakout groups, when we have the panels, we're not going to have questions and answers afterwards. Those panels are just going to be you, the speakers, in conversation with the academic. Then what we're going to do is Janet, as the chair, at the end of each panel, is going to ask people to break into groups of 7 or 8. So we've set up chairs outside and a couple of groups can work in here. And it really just gives everybody a chance to start to get to know each other a bit more informally. And also, sometimes it gives you a chance to actually reflect as a group on the sorts of questions you want to ask. Then in the afternoon, we're going to do something a little bit different. Rod Earle from the Open University is going to be talking to Isabel Gray and Adam Hamdi, crime writers, and they're going to be talking about how they research their work, what sources they use, what sources they don't use, what's left in the picture, what is left out of the picture. And in that panel, we are going to have questions and answers after that. Then we're going to do something a bit different after the coffee break. I've invited along Molly Hanley from Open Corporates. So as Meredith said in her introduction, I'm currently working on crime reporting in the digital age. And at the beginning of this year, I went to Open Corporates and interviewed Molly Hanley about the new developments in data journalism and investigative journalism. And I thought that her work would be of great interest to everybody because it's what Open Corporates does is makes sources of information available to academics, to activists, as well as writers, anyone who is interested in bringing power to account. And she's going to talk about how that works, particularly in the prison sector. And then at the end, we're going to have time for all the speakers to talk about what they've brought, what their takeaway messages are for the day, and also time for everybody here to reflect on what we do going forward. Joanna and I have obviously got ideas about what we'd like to achieve from this day, but I can't emphasise enough that this day is also, or rather, not just also, but very much about you, about what we want to achieve as a group going forward, what we think will be really good, concrete, practical things to develop from the discussions today. So I'm going to pass you over now to my fantastic co-organiser, Joanna, who's going to talk a little bit more about research in this area. But before I do, I just want to say thank you again, and I hope we're going to have a brilliant, positive, and very thought-provoking day. So thank you all for being here.
Hello, everyone. All our guests, welcome. I'm Ioanna Gussetti, the other organizer of today's event. It's our privilege and pleasure to have you with us today at the LSE to participate in our one-day conference, Breaking Prison Narratives. Marianne has already outlined the key objectives of the event, the structure of the days, the list of participants, and also, and more importantly, what engendered the idea of this event, and rightly so, because this was this has been Marianne's baby. So thanks also to Marianne for having me on board. So in my very limited time, I'll try to develop a more critical perspective, if you like, on the main objectives of this event. The criminological importance of exploring information about crime and crime-related phenomena such as punishment lies on the fact that direct or experiential knowledge about them is limited for most of us. Although this is a good thing, of course, it creates room for misconceptions and stereotypical viewpoints if the consumed information is basically low quality. This is even more so in the case of territories that are relatively inaccessible to the many, such as prisons. The lack of direct knowledge suggests that the quality of mediated knowledge is crucial in shaping perceptions of crime and criminal justice. Therefore, a great deal of criminological research has been devoted to media representations of crime and its impact on criminal behavior and public attitudes to crime. Outlining the key conclusions in this area is beyond the scope of this brief introduction, but I'd like to refer to some of the key assumptions of this body of work, which, by the way, are not always strongly supported by the data. Assumption number one: mediated knowledge about crime deviates from the reality of crime by focusing disproportionately on violent crime, offenders and victims with specific characteristics that don't always match crime stats, and a criminal justice system, the effectiveness of which in tackling crime is portrayed as unproblematic across the board. Assumption number two: mediated knowledge about crime, mediated knowledge about crime impacts on offending behavior, especially violent crime, and public attitudes to crime, especially fear of crime. Assumption number three, mediated knowledge about crime stems from sociopolitical ideologies, market dynamics, and profit-driven objectives of those who produce and disseminate it. In an attempt to take a reflexive approach, to build a reflexive approach to this conventional criminological wisdom, if you like, we suggest that, albeit not entirely incorrect or untrue, such assumptions rely on binary conceptions and dichotomies that don't add much to the criminological exploration of the relationship between media and crime. First, these assumptions draw clear boundaries between fictional and factual information about crime and crime-related phenomena, which are highly blurred in practice, especially today with the increased popularity of infotainment. Second, they produce and reproduce the idea of rational and irrational risks, with the former stemming from direct actual threats and the latter from imaginative ones, where in reality the distinction between the two is dependent, research shows, on individual and contextual parameters. Third, they rely, these assumptions, on clear-cut differences between causes and consequences of crime media imagery, which are hard to test empirically due to the key methodological features of criminological research in this area, which is primarily observational, cross-sectional, and lacking in external validity, especially when it comes to experimental research. By bringing together criminological and non-criminological knowledge, we approach media representations not as causes or consequences of anything, but as an integral part of the social meanings of prison, which inform individual and collective experiences and expressions of crime and punishment. Therefore, we don't aim through this event to educate either part of the setting, the criminologist or the crime writer and the filmmaker, but to develop a dialogue between those who produce criminological narratives and media narratives of prisons, exactly because we see them as equal parts of dominant discourses about crime and punishment. Furthermore, we suggest that they can collaborate to produce narratives that are inclusive and promote individual and collective well-being. To discuss all these issues, we are honored to have guests that are, as Marianne mentioned, esteemed specialists in their areas, and thus will help us develop constructive and critical debates. So prepare yourself to be challenged, excited, and inspired. And before I hand over to Dr. Janet Foster, who we are lucky enough to have as our chair of our event, we want to say once more, welcome. It's wonderful to have all of you here today. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to add my welcome to you as well. Marianne asked me to talk today on a day when we're going to talk quite a lot about prisons. I'm a policing researcher, not a prisons researcher. But I have literally spent years of my life in places that other people would prefer not to go, and thousands of hours in the back of police cars doing research as an ethnographer. And for me, understanding the social world starts with actually observing that world in practice. And it's changed my perspective on the world fundamentally. And for many years, I worked at the University of Cambridge with very senior police officers who'd been selected for the highest ranks of the service. And the idea was to try and bring criminology, to find a bridge where we would be able to bring criminology to their practice. And what I'm going to do today is that Marianne asked me to use my forthcoming book, The Real Sherlock's Murder Investigators at Work, which is based on 3 years of following murder cases from crime scene to courtroom, to talk about some of the themes and issues, to place a context around what we're going to discuss today in different ways. And I've done this pictorially, and I've used a few quotations from the research to illustrate this. The first thing I wanted to say is that, perhaps surprisingly for people from the crime writing world, you'd be amazed how powerful the images that people garner through crime fiction are in real life situations. In fact, I've had students in my classes asking if we can watch crime dramas in our criminology classes, as if these are a representation in some sort of way of quote unquote reality. And the important thing is that the Crime Survey of England and Wales tells us that the really important thing is that the media of various different kinds, increasingly social media, has a massive impact on people's perceptions and may indeed be the most important foundational part of their knowledge. And so what I want to talk about today is these kind of ripple effects. It's like a pebble in a pond. But I want to show you how that actually affects the actual experiences that murder investigators have in their work and how they construct their world, sometimes employing these sorts of media images. Now, the first thing is that crime fiction is all about story construction, brilliant story construction in many cases. And the really interesting thing is that motive is at the heart of every crime drama. In real life, motive is the most difficult thing to establish often in crime investigation. And I couldn't believe it. I'd spent months and months with the murder team and I kept thinking, people aren't talking about motive in a way that I expected them to. And that's because they don't fill in their crime stories, the things that we get all the time fed to us through crime drama, which is that we get to see what's going on behind the scenes, not just simply what's going on, what the police happen to know at that moment in time. And so police officers always start at the end of the story, when the body is found, rather than a story construction that starts from the beginning. And I know that Alex will probably talk about this, but in real life situations involving murder investigations, story construction of it in its extreme form actually starts when the police pass over files to prosecutors who then put together a credible and as simplified as possible story to present to a jury. So there are all kinds of issues to do with story construction. But the really important issue here is about closure. And Richard, in his book on television and crime drama, actually talks about how important it is as an audience for us to have a degree of closure in crime dramas. And in real life, unfortunately, there isn't that same degree of closure. In fact, I was desperate for the entire time I was doing this research to be able to kind of finish the circle, to be able to really understand. And what I had to accept is that it's impossible, not least because most people who are accused of murder no comment in their interviews. So if those people are responsible for those murders and could tell us their stories, they don't tell generally the police their stories because legal counsel tells them not to, but also because they know that they're going through a criminal justice process where the constructed story that's told in court is the thing that will or won't get them found guilty or innocent. So in a sense, we never know what the story is, and I can't tell you how dissatisfying that is. It's really dissatisfying. So what we get then is that we get, in crime fiction, we get fantasy with glimpses of authenticity. And these, the fantasy is particularly around victim profiles. And in fact, up here I've said that in my view, crime dramas ought to carry a disclaimer at the end of those things that says, this is a story. Murder affects a very small proportion of people. Women, except at the hands of their partners or former partners, are less likely to be victims of murder than men. Multiple homicides are incredibly rare. Not Midsummer Murders, you know, where, and in fact, almost in every crime crime drama, we have multiple murders. But these things have an impact on people's perceptions of what's going on because there isn't that much information available. And a lot of the focus in crime drama is on the procedural things. And yet I have never seen in a crime drama somebody saying, I need to take the PACE codes, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act codes with me in order to ensure that I get these things right. I have seen that in real life. And the reason for that is that what police officers do at the point of, at the first point, may have an impact to the likelihood of a case being successfully prosecuted. So lots of the ways of the stories of the way detectives behave in those dramas has an impact in practice. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take you through these pebbles in the ponds, the ripple effects, and how what happens in fiction has an impact on real life. The first thing is that these ripple effects in terms of what we are fed in the media shapes perceptions of real policing and interactions. And the first thing it does is that it affects our fear of crime. So this is a detective talking, and he says, years ago there was a crime, but it happened behind police station walls, and the public didn't have access to what was going on. They didn't have 56 news channels that were desperate for something to put on the news, and crime is newsworthy. By having this very global society, we've raised the fear of crime, because if somebody gets raped in a particular place, and it's a young child, people in another place or another country see it on the news or social media, and that raises fear of crime for their own children. And these are very, very important messages. But also, and very interestingly, this also has an impact. The media portrayals have an impact on detectives themselves. And here's one detective constable who's saying, the police haven't got a voice where you can come over, either in the newspapers or on TV, and say, well, hang on a minute, that is wrong. So the public's perception is, what the hell are the police doing? We're a load of buffoons. And actually the thing that irritates the hell out of me is that the presentation of senior police officers is so cardboard-like in crime dramas. They are always creating difficulties and problems. There's never a kind of an understanding of the processes and structures involved in crime investigation. But in terms of what happens to real-life detectives who are out engaged in real-life crime investigation is that there is a symbolism that is associated with crime drama that is articulated in this senior investigating officer's comments, and he's the head of a murder inquiry. And he's describing going to see a family for the very first time, as senior investigating officers do within the first 24 to 36 hours of every murder investigation. And he says, I was treated as a very important person, almost a magisterial entrance into the room, and best china awaiting. People get their perceptions from TV, don't they? They think, cool, he's the DCI, he must be important, and he's the head of the murder squad. That means something, and with that family, I played that part. I sensed that they wanted me to be that type of person. Now, that's fine for a family for whom trust in the police is quite considerable, but for many black and minority ethnic families, there were desperate, desperate problems about a disjuncture between the expectations they had of what it was possible for the police to achieve and what actually happened in practice. And for many, this was construed as racism, pure and simple. But actually, when you look at the dynamics of those interactions, the framework and structure that people had began with crime dramas. So they asked to go to the incident room, and the incident room does not have pictures and photographs and lines and all of these wonderful things. So for families going into the incident room, there is a massive anticlimax. But they interpret that as the police don't care. They're not paying any attention. Where is the photograph of my child on that wall? And they are incredibly sensitive to those issues, as with what Stevens calls the CSI effect. And with the CSI effect, there is an expectation, you just do forensic tests. They take 2 seconds to do. No, they take weeks, sometimes months, and mostly people have been found well before the forensic tests are back. So all of these expectations play into real life. But I just want to finish by showing you by using a quotation from an inspector that talks about why murder is important to all of us symbolically, and why it is that we are to some extent so locked into crime dramas. And murder investigation in real life is somewhat more mundane than its fictional counterpart, in part because the emphasis is so much on the whodunit in crime fiction as opposed to crime practice. But I want to use the words of one of the inspectors who talks about the importance of a moral crusade. And that moral crusade is reflected in crime fiction. It's about the dedication and determination of individual detectives to find the bad guys. And this is something that is shared by murder detectives. But what's important, as this officer says, is he says, I've got that moral obligation to go that extra mile because someone has died and it's my responsibility to seek justice on their behalf. I start with the victim, and it doesn't matter who the victim is. Frequently, our victims would not be particularly likable people, rarely presented in crime fiction, but they're still dead. And no matter what you think of that person, they've been killed on our streets. This is where the symbolic importance comes in. And I think you have to think beyond that person, beyond the family sometimes, and just realise this is a murder in our city, and every murder in our city takes away from the quality of our lives. Part of being a police officer is to serve everybody in London, improve the quality of life for everybody in London. You're not just serving that person, you're serving that person's family. It's to make it better for everybody. So one of the things I want to thank the crime writers in the room for is bringing a sense of closure that never happens in real life. But for me, this is as near as it gets. Thanks very much. Started late. We are now going to move on to our panel. So we're just going to have just a couple of seconds while we move seats and so on.
This is an academic conference, isn't everyone wondering about?
Alex has escaped.
Yeah, he's just
at the other end of the room.
That's what he's telling you.
Which of you?
Okay, thank you.
No, I'm just gonna
flip
the
format.
The only problem is
in
the danger of sitting in
front of the Oh, okay. Sure, we can shift along.
Do you think we could move around the time of
the Yeah, yes. Sure, we could.
Is that enough?
I'm sure it's fine, yes.
I guess
fine.
Thank you.
Uh-oh.
Dan.
Sean.
Nice to meet you, Dan.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Dan.
I'm Richard.
One of our members has just nipped out to the loo, so we'll be here in a minute. It's probably a good idea to actually talk to the person next to you if you don't know them and introduce yourself and say hello. When I was speaking, some of those ideas haven't really, I don't think, been properly discussed and adequately since you wrote that book.
1992.
Hugely influential book, which I definitely recommend that you
read. Guys.
Then next to me here is Alex McBride. He's a criminal barrister, and that's why I said that Alex may talk about the courtroom stuff. But in a lovely example, like Marianne's story, of the interchangeability between moving from professions into crime writing. And he was shortlisted for the 2010 Crime Writers Association Golden Dagger, so that's a huge privilege. And then Don Sefton, again, an illustrator. Dan. Dan Sefton, who is a qualified doctor and also now working as a writer. Including the Good Karma Hospital, which I really love, actually. I really love that programme.
I used to be the forensic medical examiner as well, which I forgot to add, which
fantastic.
Is ridiculous. Well, I forgot to add.
That's highly relevant, isn't it? I don't know whether or not to call you.
It's Sean's fame, it's not Sean. My name. The name was given by the publisher.
a man with two identities. And I liked the way you said in your bio that you were a reformed television writer.
Try to stay away from TV.
But now writing novels, and I thought the thing that was absolutely fascinating is that you've got an evidence-based approach to your writing, and that you've trained as close protection bodyguard, so I'm sure you have things to...
It's also called having recurrent midlife crises.
And you've actually also been in a Supermax prison in California. So, very distinguished panel. I'm going to... everybody's been asked to speak for 5 minutes, as I understand it. Richard, do you want to kick off?
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much. Thanks for organising this very, very interesting day, and thank you for inviting me. So, I know that already the day is not only about prisons, but... It is called Breaking Prison Narrative, so I'm going to talk about narrative representations of prisons a little bit, because I'm the only academic on the panel. I thought it was necessary to have a PowerPoint presentation. So, although I do dispute this expertise thing that was bandied about in relation to me, I feel very inexpert on every level in this context, but still. So I do want to talk about prisons, because I think... That is one of the more important and less discussed aspects of this whole kind of question of crime, representation of crime and punishment in in media. And just for convenience, I'm not really going to talk about television. I'm just going to give a few examples from film, from cinema history, because I think that's all I can do in the few minutes available. Prisons are important, one might say emblematic, institutions of modern societies. And this has given us a whole variety of ways of speaking about them, but ways in which they also can filter into popular cultural forms in recurrent, interesting, powerful, but I think also problematic form. I'm going to try and illustrate that in a moment. But just to begin, because this is also part of the whole framing of the day, I thought we might briefly say something about what we mean by narrative in this context and why sometimes narratives are things that one might wish to break or break out from. Because a narrative is any story. It's any way in which we comment upon human experience, when we speak about ourselves, when we talk about the story of our own life, or when we describe any kind of sequence of events, you can argue that we are narrating these things. And there are a whole kind of wide and interesting movement of kind of narrative studies in the social sciences at the moment that focus very much on those kinds of everyday stories and their purposes. And that can be for a whole host of reasons, for personal expression, for entertainment, for instruction. Narrative is inescapably, breaking out of it or otherwise, one of the ways of organising what are otherwise chaotic experiences that just flow over us. We need them, we use them, we operate in and through them, we communicate through them, visibly or otherwise, all the time. But narrative in the context of when we think about mass media, when we think about cinema, when we think about television, also refers to certain kind of formats into which these experiences are organised and with which we become familiar and know how to kind of recognise and move around. So that narratives also means kind of characteristic repertoires of images and sequences, things that recur, a particular way of framing experience for us by others in the ways in which we receive and consume them. So why prisons? What are prison narratives like? And how helpful or how limiting are they in ways of depicting the kind of human activities and institutions involved in that institution? Are they problematic in the sense that they impose certain kind of dominant forms which recur, perhaps in ways that become limiting or, to quote a phrase, confining in themselves? I want to argue that prison narratives are often of this kind, partly because of something quite deep about the place of the prison itself as an institution in modern societies, that we have a kind of ambivalence about prisons that is built into its history, that arises early in that history and runs very deep in our social responses to prisons. I'm going to give you probably can't read this, but these are just ways of very, very briefly illustrating that point, that all arise within the relatively early history of the development of modern prisons. So the top one, I'll read it out in case people can't read it. This is from the report of the inspectors of the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia in around 1830, in which they described their prison as, quotes, the beautiful gate of the temple, leading by a happy life and a peaceful end to heaven. In other words, that there was something ideal, something kind of transformative about the idea of the prison at the moment of its creation. That's what people thought it was. It was an ideal institution. It was going to change people. And in changing people, it was going to change many things about their social life. And de Tocqueville and de Beaumont in 1834, writing about prisons in America, to report back to the French government, which sent them there, spoke about the creation of what they called a new kind of prison, one for which humanity need not blush. So the 19th century, the late 18th, early 19th century of the prison includes these kinds of ideal images about the prison as a transformative place. Later, not much later though, the doubts kind of really set in, and you hear other people saying other things about prisons and all of their kind of deep and inherent problem. So Dickens writing about his visits to prisons in Philadelphia, the very same prisons or some of the same prisons, speaks about the prison as an immense amount of torture and agony sustained for years, prolonged for years, inflicting upon the inmates an awful punishment that returns them to society morally unhealthy and diseased. And a little bit later, Winston Churchill, speaking in the House of Commons, refers to not allowing optimism or hope or benevolence to carry us too far, because after all material improvement has been effected, he says, when the temperature has been rightly adjusted, the proper amount of food has been given, the prisoner still stands deprived of everything the free person calls life. So there's the point is, prisons are one of the emblematic institutions of modernity, but they're one of which we had doubts, and those doubts set in early, yet we still have them. We don't have the same, the other institutions that we created around the same time, hospitals, schools, mass transport and drainage systems, we don't ask ourselves in the same way, why do we still have hospitals, why do we still have schools, why do we still need sewage? But we do ask ourselves those kinds of questions about prisons, and yet they come from the same moment and have lasted about the same length of time. So there's something about prisons that gives rise to deeply mixed and ambivalent feelings, I think. And I think that we can see this, or traces of this and effects of this, in our representations of them, that they are deeply problematic and yet in a certain sense inevitable, inescapable, is part of the way in which we tend to receive that story. So I thought that here's a kind of, sorry guys, you probably can't say, a miscellaneous but not entirely random little selection of images of prison films. And what I want to say about it is just a very few things. I know I'm already in danger of overrunning my time. First of all, prisons do recur. They're not a small feature of the history of cinema or kind of literature. They're actually very, very central. They provide, I would argue, a certain kind of set of resources of basic metaphors to which narrative keeps returning, that are images of obviously of confinement, of being bundled together with a small number of people under problematic circumstances and all of those things. They sometimes feature in some of the what by common agreement in most sort of histories of cinema are amongst the kind of great triumphs of high cinematic art, in films like La Grande Illusion or Un Condamné à Mort, S'est Échappé, A Man Escaped, or The Wind Bloweth Where It Will, and so on. Or in the sort of some of the great narratives of personal triumph over adversity, as in The Birdman of Alcatraz, and so on and so forth. But if we think about prison narratives in cinema now, I think we see something curious. So down on the right, I'll just move aside for a moment so you can see him. We have a certain kind of continuity, I think, that runs directly in modern times, being this kind of the image of the little guy in the suit overcoming his circumstances at the prison, straight to Paddington 2, who is in effect Chaplin represented as a teddy bear. I was a fugitive from a chain gang. Our image of the prisoner is in a certain sense constant in that case. It's a version of what is sometimes called a hero's journey story, that the individual is subjected to a set of challenges which takes them into another world, sometimes in that sort of form of narratology called the abyss, from which they return changed in some way. So bring back some kind of other gift for that. That's absolutely the story of Paddington 2. I think Paddington 2 is a hero's journey narrative in this kind of classic sense. It recurs. It is recurrent. And that means it is sometimes seen as unchanging. But I'm also concerned about the gothic, if you might call it that, in contemporary prison film, And I've got two examples over there. The top one everyone will recognise is, of course, from that great masterpiece, Kung Fu Panda. And below it is obviously the prison of Azkaban in the Harry Potter stories. Prisons in those kinds of depictions are monstrous places, often populated by monsters, and in the case of the Harry Potter stories, literally run by monsters. And there's a slippage, there's a small, difficult slippage between the idea of a prison being a monstrous place and a place inhabited by monstrous beings. And that's something that I think we need to think about carefully too.
I'm really sorry, but I have to stop.
Do you want to conclude? Yes. The point is, we have many, many stories about personal change in prison in some of these traditions. The Birdman of Alcatraz is a story about personal change, albeit it's a story about a man who died in prison. The Shawshank Redemption, which is on so many people's lists of favourite films, is a story about a certain kind of personal change or transformation. We have very few stories that are about the change or transformation of the prison institution, because there's something that runs deep in the history of these stories that doesn't promote that level of critique or understanding. And I can think of very few examples, if any, of cinematic depictions of anything like this degree of centrality to the culture that tell us really anything about the great social experiment of mass incarceration in the United States. Something enormous happened, and yet it is almost absent from our popular cultural understanding. Why is that? That's it.
Is that you have an opportunity to talk to Richard later, and this is a networking event, so please make good use of him. Sean, do you want to?
Sure. having listened to all the kind of comments so far, probably the first thing I should say is I plead guilty to some of this in terms of getting things wrong. So probably the main reason I'm here, the second thriller in my main series, a book called Deadlock, and it was set in a place in the United States called Pelican Bay. Supermax, and the kind of headline stat to explain Pelican Bay is 3,500 male inmates, 70% of whom are serving life without possibility of parole. So you have in California, death row is San Quentin, and then you have Pelican Bay. But in terms of the types of stories you tell, perhaps if I talk a little bit about how I came to go inside Pelican Bay and how difficult it was, that might inform how, by the authorities, writers get steered. So the process of going into Pelican Bay was a very long and arduous one. And the only way they actually allowed me to go inside was, I happened to be lucky enough that my father-in-law is connected politically. He's got a fairly political heavyweight in California, so he made a couple of phone calls after I wouldn't shut up about trying to get in this prison, and the doors magically opened. But the first thing you do when you step inside Pelican Bay, and I met a lieutenant that showed me around, first thing they do is they make you sign the no hostages policy. So you have to say that I understand that if I am taken hostage while inside Pelican Bay, no negotiation will take place for my release, and I kind of discharge any kind of, you know, legal liability. So, I mean, immediately that's going to frame, you know, how you're going to view that place before you go in. The second thing they said to me was, don't wear blue, because the inmates wear blue. And I said, oh, is it like an escape attempt thing? He said, no, occasionally we have to shoot people. And so I went out. By the time I got on the yard in Pelican Bay, I looked like a kind of TV children's presenter. You know, I had like the reddest kind of T-shirt, fleece.
Your waist ripped.
Yeah, I could possibly. And then the third thing, and this was really the most revealing thing, because Pelican Bay has been brought up by Amnesty International because of the conditions, mainly the fact that I think about 1,200 of the 3,500 are kept in the secure housing unit, so 23 hours out of 24. So the rule was you cannot speak to the prisoners. You can't speak to the prisoners. So I knew going in, you know, if you can't talk to the people that are inside, and a couple of them tried to speak to me, because obviously because they're in their cell, they saw someone new that wasn't in a uniform, you know, and I had some kind of limited conversation, you know, you are being corralled. On the other side of it, and most people, it's funny, I was looking at the Churchill quote, and I thought, you know, who knew Churchill was a pinko, you know, liberal, saying that the actual punishment should be the fact that you're in prison, you know? It shouldn't be whether you have a TV or not, or any of the other stuff that the Daily Mail gets excited about. But when I was preparing to come here, I had a chance to put an interview with Richard Pryor that kind of summed up how I felt to a degree going into Pelican Bay. And Richard Pryor, when he was making the film Stir Crazy with Gene Wilder, said, you know, when he went into the prison, he said, you know, I was like, I'm down with the brothers, man, you know, like, you know, the oppression. And he said, then I started meeting some of these people. And I thought, if I see you walking down my drive, I'm going to blow your head off, you know. So you're kind of, in a sense, the way I looked at Pelican Bay was there were people in Pelican Bay that, as they are presently constituted as human beings, should not be in wider society. You know, if you've committed 3 or 4, you know, KNR, kidnap for ransom cases, and they've all ended up with the victim dead, you know, like you haven't managed to work out the ransom and exchange part, you are probably best, for everyone's sake, out of society. But then, and also just picking up on your point, Richard, I mean, when I was very young, one of the, and I imagine that this is a non, this is a biography or autobiography, but it probably is the only book that I could think of when you said that there's no books, there's no narratives that deal with prison system, is Jimmy Boyle's book, A Sense of Freedom, which was a kind of pivotal book for me growing up, and I had the good fortune to meet him when I was quite a young man, and he made a kind of huge impression on me. And for those not aware, Jimmy Boyle was famously dubbed Scotland's most violent man. He'd allegedly crucified someone, and he certainly was. He was, by his own admission, a very violent guy. I think they discussed in the House of Commons bringing the death penalty back retroactively so they could execute Jimmy Boyle. And he's now a wine and fine art dealer, I think, in Morocco. And that came about because of the special unit in Barlinnie where they used art therapy with the prisoners. And then the last thing I want to say, and I'll wind up, is, and I think Marianne touched on this, she did it extremely well, is on the one hand, look, my duty is writing thrillers. When I was working with a publisher, I work directly now. When I was working with a publisher, they had paid me in advance. I have to write a book that they can sell to repay that advance. I have a mortgage, I have a family, and the way I sell those books is by making them entertaining. So if it comes down to being absolutely accurate, you know, with the research and telling the most entertaining story, I mean, I'm just going to be honest, I'm going to go with the story. You know, I'm not going to... And in fact, when I was writing Deadlock, I'd planned for about half of the book to be set in the prison, and I got a third of the way through and thought, my God, like, I can't, you know, like, there's not enough story here, because it's, you know, it's 23 hours in their cell. You know, it's not a documentary, so it wasn't going to work. Having said that, I do think that when you can get, there are moments in research, and readers certainly look for this, where if you can find, and I think the crime writer that does it, I think better, no disrespect to anyone here, because I think he's absolutely at the top of the tree, is a writer like the American writer Don Winslow, who does intensive research over decades, and writes brilliantly about criminals and criminal motivation. So I think where the research can help writers do a better job, that's great. I mean, I spent a lot of time in working in UK TV. You know, am I going to sacrifice the story to make the book perfectly accurate? No, I'm not. You know, I'm just not. I don't feel that's my primary responsibility, but I certainly think things like this exchange are helpful and are beneficial to everyone.
Thanks very much.
Hello. I'm just excited by the idea of no hostages to moving, which I've already started working on. I think the reason it's an obvious movie pitch is why it's part of the story here, isn't it? Because if the writer, probably not sure because he looks too tough, somebody like me ends up a hostage in Pelican Bay with a no hostages policy and I have to somehow survive to the end of 90 minutes, that's an interesting, exciting movie already. You know, starring, I don't know, somebody, I'll think about it.
Copyright it here.
Yeah, well, I've said it now, it's copyright. The point is, I'm coming from this point of view that what we're doing in the television industry is primarily entertainment. And sometimes it's based off fact, but mostly it's for entertainment. And we're driven by that, by forces way outside the control of any writer or producer or individual production company. We're driven by that, by the public. So I think that's really important to understand. I think one thing that could be useful today is a communication between the people on the academic side of the fence and the people who are actually making the programs right now and understand how it is actually done in great detail, which I'll be happy to talk about. I think that drama and nonfiction are very different. I mean, what the big challenge for drama at the moment on television is the rise of these sort of true crime type podcasts and narratives like The Staircase and things like that, which are incredibly popular. And on TV, things like Three Girls has been very popular, Little Boy Blue has been very popular. I think there's a fundamental category difference between those and drama. Those are popular because they are true. And people watch them because they are true and they're expecting to get the truth and that's why they're watching them. If you try and tell a fictional narrative in that style, which isn't true, people are bored because it's not that interesting. The value they get from it is the truth. So there is you can't mix those two up and go, that will work. You can take aspects of veracity from reality, well, that's a tautology, and mix it in seasoning to make it feel true, but your primary duty is to the narrative and to the audience and to the entertainment, and that's the only truth. I think that prison is often represented as scary is because, one, it is. Two, because anarchy and forces of fear and conflict are a necessity for drama. So the prison is like a contemporary Wild West, and all the things of Wild West narratives that you can have, a guy walks into a town which is very dangerous, everybody's got a gun and they can kill you, it's essentially exciting, which is really what's happening, and people get off on terror. I mean, the reason most crime fiction and most television fiction of crime is consumed by women, and I think the reason that most of the victims are female is because it's playing to the fear of the audience. It's the scariest thing you can possibly put on. So TV's always pushing towards the extremes. How scary, how quick, how bigger, how much bigger, and how much faster. And that is accelerating in the last few years. So what the challenge is for people like me is to keep up with the insatiable demand for more story, more shocks, more thrills, more gore, more excitement. If you look back at television even 15 years ago, my God, it's slow. I mean, you watch it out of a sense of, well, it's kind of interesting. But really, there's almost no comparison. So I think part of the problem is that, you know, the facts of prison life and crime are complex and nuanced. And I've worked in both. I was, as I said, I was a forensic medical examiner for about 5 years. So I spent a lot of time in police custody working with prisoners and police officers and trying to tell the difference. And, and you know, the facts of that thing are complex and nuanced. And you know, drama, the way it's presented on TV and film particularly, it's not the best place to put that in. What it is good at is psychology, done well. So human psychology is complex and nuanced, and that's really the arena that drama is working. It's working on telling stories about complicated people and their motivations and why they've done it and how they react. And that is really where we should be looking for truth in drama, not in necessarily the facts around the environment, because you can get that from lots of other sources. If you look at prison narratives, prison movies, I mean, my top four are Cool Hand Luke by Miles, Papillon, Longest Yard, Midnight Express, they're all the same story. They're all the same story of a fairly, you know, weak person being challenged by an incredibly difficult environment and coming through. And that is really every story that's ever been written about anything. Anything that's not that is not mainstream. It is an anti-plot movie, as Robert McKee would say. It is something which is a very narrow appeal. Not no appeal, but narrow appeal. So I think we have to be careful about looking at what is popular mainstream entertainment, mainstream drama, mainstream narrative, and what is niche narrative, and not try and conflate the two, because if you do, you'll fail. I'll finish on the same. I think the catch-22 that I've got, because I've worked on several ideas for prison shows, which haven't actually come to fruition, but the biggest difficulty I've had is that they won't let you in. And this is with, you know, lots of proper approaches through, you know, reasonable way, but they just won't let you in because they are scared of what you're going to say, because they've seen so many prison shows and crime shows which are bullshit. And so the problem is, if you can't get in, you can't actually delve into what the reality is. So then you end up going, well, I'm just going to write whatever I want then. You know, and then it goes round and round and round in circles. So I think until we break that circle, until the people who are running prisons and running the police service have a little bit more time for writers and allow them to come in, then we'll never break that. And they'll need to stop complaining, because if you won't let us in to have a look, you know, the demand's there, it'll be written by somebody.
Great, thank you so much.
Well, I don't want to repeat exactly what Sean and Dan have said, but I entirely agree with them. The first sort of rule when trying to write a piece of crime fiction is to be entertaining. But that does mean, as Dan has said, and I mean, it's really right, is to have a good character and to have a truthful character. And so the precinct or the milieu that you put them in don't necessarily have to be absolutely accurate. However, there is one proviso that I would add, a rider to that, which is, if you're going to choose prison as a world, and Dan and I have been working on a show, and we have chosen prison as our world, you want to get it right, because you don't want to do what the director Paul Greengrass refers to, is you don't want to be living off free petrol. By which he means you don't want to be there just cheating it and taking it for your own interest and your own self-interest. And there's a very good reason for that, and it's not just not wanting to do that because that would be a bad thing, but it would, I can guarantee you, it would make a shitty drama and no one would want to watch it. It's got to be a truthful world to make it a good story. But it's the character, and giving your character enormous amounts of obstacles, as Dan has outlined in Cool Hand Luke, Shawshank Redemption, throwing the obstacles, making it worse and worse and worse for them. And that's why prison is such a fantastic world to set it in, because you can throw the most appalling monsters up against the shy, unassuming man or woman and create a brilliant story that people want to watch. And we are, after all, in a very commercial world, and you live and die by whether people want to buy your show or watch your show. The other thing I would say regarding that is access to prisons is extremely difficult, as Dan has said, but I have noticed in the last year or so that people are getting access, getting amazing access. I don't know if anyone saw Paddy Wivel's film Prison. I think it was on Channel 4. I mean, his access was utterly astonishing, and I don't know how set up it was, and I'm not criticising him at all. I thought it was amazing. Access is absolutely key, and indeed the visiting professor who I've met before, he won't remember me, but I remember him, Roger Grafe, who made an amazing film. Hello there, Roger. An amazing film about the Thames Valley Police. And I've never been able to, and I saw it when I was 10 years old, and I've never been able to look at the police in the same way. I'm not saying that the police are bad people at all, but you saw how it really was and what real people in stressful situations can be like. And it works because it's extremely well put together, but because Roger managed to get the access. He talked his way in there. I have one advantage because I'm a criminal barrister, so I can get into prisons pretty easily by just going to say that I'm visiting a client. I would need to find a client, but I should probably turn off the recording. But there are ways around this. So going into prisons like Long Larton, which is a Cat A high security, very serious criminals. It's very different from going to a general Cat B place where people are doing 4 years for fraud rather than 25 years for some for conspiracy to murder. The only other thing I would add, which is just on case theory, because you brought it up in terms of motive, and I'm sorry if I'm overrunning. It's so true. When you get a case summary, when you prepare a case, if you're prosecuting, you get a case summary from the police, and you look at it, you think, God, these coppers, they don't have any idea of story at all. I mean, it's just one sentence, and it's after another, and it's not connected at all. The first thing you do when you prosecute a case, is you say, you don't say motive, because that would be too close to the bone. You say, what's my case theory? Which is, of course, what's the motive here? What's the story? And you construct it from the strands and from the stories and from the things that you pull together. And often, the best stories are not entirely satisfactorily resolved, because then you have the payoff at the very end is, did it really happen that way? Is there something that they missed? And that's a nice tingle for the audience, so just before the credits roll. Thank you.
Excellent. Right, well, what I'm proposing we're going to do is we're going to spend 10 minutes now just with, I'll kick off the questions, and then we're going to change the timetable slightly, as you won't be surprised about, and then what we'll do is that we'll go into coffee and take coffee with you into the breakout groups, because we want to make sure that you've got enough time to be able to talk to one another and share these ideas. One of the things I want to raise to kick off the discussion is I hadn't realised quite how difficult it was for writers to get access. And it seems to me that one of the really interesting contrasts here is that in this room are people who've literally spent years of their life in different parts of criminal justice institutions. So I'm wondering, first off, what kind of stories you might write if you had been able to speak to. It seems to be absurd. The whole point of going to prison, would it not be, is to actually talk to inmates about their experiences. But if you were able to access inmates, what kind of different stories do you think you would write?
Everyone's looking at me.
it's an open invitation.
Yeah, there's one thing, and I put this just out there, if anyone knows any kind of criminal forensic psychologist, psychiatrist, there is a book I want to write about familicide. So if let's say has experience with familicide, but if anyone knows of any cases or they could put me in touch, I'd be very interested in that. I mean, I think the more general point is about allowing people access to whether it's police forces or prisons is, you know, writers, we're only looking to stitch you up in as much as it's a good story. You know, I mean, the reason most detectives, you know, you have that trope of the troubled detective is, if you go, you know, it's because writers have spent time talking. You know, if you talk to someone, you could talk to someone that could be in for 20 years for committing the most horrific crime, and you spend half a day with them, you're going to find something you like about that person. And, you know, that's good writing. I mean, good writing is three-dimensional. I mean, that's the, you know, and I think all writers, you have to have that empathy for all sorts of people rather than just the headline. And the same goes for people in the prison system or the police. So I think if you know, I mean, Alex really alluded to this, if you don't give writers a fair shake, we'll just go make it up, you know? So that's the choice that faces people.
I think for me, how it works for me is that you don't go looking for stories per se. I mean, you get them, but you go looking for the killer details. That's what you get from research. You go looking for the hidden stuff, which is why it's difficult, because I've worked in medicine all my life, and I know all the inside track on that much more than I do about crime. And when we have things like 24 Hours in A&E, people go, oh, it's so realistic. I'm going, no, it's fucking not, because it's just because they tell you what they want, and they're all going like, I did this, I did that. You don't get the secrets. You don't get the bottle of whiskey in the desk, which is what you get in a drama, which is why drama can be fundamentally more truthful than this kind of documentaries, because they're all just whitewashed. So what you need is to be able to talk to people and go, what's the worst thing you've ever done? What's the thing? I'll go, oh my God, well, at this time, this prisoner did this, he jumped off here, and this happened, and then we go, right, that's it. And somebody told me about an army thing where they said, you know, they were in Iraq and all these the people hung their legs from the trees. I'm like, that's a detail I'm keeping. And he said, no, it didn't happen very often. I said, I don't care, you know, because that's a really good detail. So I think that's what you're looking for. It's not about what stories to tell. It's about getting under the skin of the details of the world. Because TV particularly, novels to a certain extent, but TV, I think people don't realise just how forensic the camera is in the sense that every single little detail is shown and there. So you have to try and get everything right. So even people who are doing production design, all the way down to what's on the walls, you know, what the posters are like, what pens they've got, they're thinking about that. So the more detail you have as a screenwriter, the more truthful the whole thing is. But you can't get that without actually going and seeing what people like and also looking at what desks, what chairs they have.
Yeah. I should also add that if you've got a severed leg hanging from a tree, you've got a bit of boring exposition that you have to get across to the audience, there's a good point to put it in, because you're now going to be looking at, look at that leg.
I told you it was bad. I told you it was dangerous. Just look around you.
Several things. First, you have also visited Pelican Bay and did a little documentary there many, many years ago. You didn't mention the stuff. I also thought that I can't speak to... I can only speak to random prisoners, and I can speak to staff quite freely, and I found their stories really, really interesting. So if you go there again, maybe try speaking to staff.
I mean, I think part of the problem with it was, A, they didn't want to let me in. I thought he pulled some strings, but they'd also had a very serious incident there a week before that had a riot. So they were on lockdown. Everyone apart from the Hispanic prisoners. The other thing about Pelican Bay is it's divided strictly by race. Yeah. Strictly by race. So a white inmate associating with a black inmate is going to be greenlit. He's going to be seriously assaulted or killed. That one of the things that the staff told me was a white inmate that associates with black prisoners is regarded as lower than a child molester.
Well, and obviously they're feeding into it by segregating them.
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, there's a political dimension. I mean, coming back to your question, and you guys touched on it, I mean, apart from details, the other thing is expectation, you know, and what ideas we have about people. I mean, the first kind of big chunk of research I did with close protection operatives, and they were all ex-military guys, was they were not what I thought they would be like. They were the two things that struck me about them, and I'm sure you'd find it the same in all sorts of supposedly quite kind of macho societies, was that those guys are the least macho people you'll meet. They're always like hugging you, like, get off, man, you know. And also they have a very, very dark sense of humour. So when you find this, you know, it's details, but also when you spend time with people, you go, oh my God, you're a great character. You know, I'm going to change your name and I might amalgamate you with this person, you know, over here. But, and I think that's where you see TV drama that's really cardboard. You know, because, you're talking about, you know, that borrowing someone's fuel, and you see it's based on 100 other detective shows that someone's seen. And viewers and readers can tell it, like, straight off the bat.
I think it's true that there are very few really... insightful depictions of people who work in prisons or people who run them. That is possible. That could be, that is something that could be done. Perhaps to explored further. But Sean mentioned Jimmy Boyle and the Bologna Special Unit. I still think there's a great film, a film for now, perhaps, to be made about that institution. Mm-hmm. It was very productive in its time, but I think that is a genuine dramatic, and what that also tells us is another kind of prison narrative, is which doesn't pose all the same access issues. Is what is life after prison? So the you know, homecomings, returns, re-entry to society. Perhaps some of the most important stories we could tell ourselves now have to do with that struggle, and of course that also enables you to think about prison as a kind of episode in people's lives, as a kind of rather than something that is the sole scene.